Welcome to On Good Authority. I'm Barbara Alexander. You are listening to, or reading, an interview with Arthur Nielsen, M.D. In his article in the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Association, Dr. Nielsen writes that one in five first marriages in the United States will fail within 5 years, and 40 to 50% ultimately end in divorce. Plus, nearly a third of married couples report significant relational distress at any point in time. He writes that understanding projective identification, quote, offers a powerful lens through which therapists can examine and treat marital dysfunction and discontent, end quote. Projective identification is a defense mechanism by which individuals unconsciously recruit others to help them tolerate painful intrapsychic states of mind. Once therapists grasp the psychodynamics of projective identification, then, using tact and empathy, they will be able to significantly help couples become more self-reflective and aware of the minds of their partners. In this interview, Dr. Nielsen uses a number of clinical examples to demonstrate this. Dr. Nielsen is a board-certified psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, and couple therapist with offices in Chicago. A clinical associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral science at the Feinberg School of Medicine, Northwestern University, Chicago, he is, as well, on the faculty of the Chicago Psychoanalytic Institute and on the faculty of the Family Institute at Northwestern University. He is the author of numerous articles on psychodynamic couple therapy, and his most recent book is A Roadmap for Couple Therapy, Integrating Systemic, Psychodynamic, and Behavioral Approaches. Dr. Nielsen, I'm just very excited to speak with you today and hear you talk to us about your extensive study and work and clinical work and research on the subject of couple counseling and the contributions of psychoanalytic thought to the field of couple therapy. And I think a lot of this is pretty new, at least to me as an older practitioner, but it's pretty new. So Okay. Why don't we just begin with you talking to us about psychoanalytic thought and how it can apply to couples therapy.
Sure. Well, thanks, Barbara. I'm excited to be here and have a chance to talk about this. I love working with couples. The advantage of working with couples, of course, is you can see both people in the room interacting with each other. You don't have to imagine how their fights go on Friday night. And so when you do that, in some ways, it's like a psychoanalysis in that the here and now of the process is tremendously important. But the psychoanalytic contributions, right away, they strike you in terms of people's defensiveness, that they have a terrible time fielding criticisms, that they defend themselves. They have a hard time asking for things. Sometimes I thought I could just write summarize couples' problems with those two issues, fielding criticism, which is emotionally hard for people, and then asking for things because it makes them vulnerable. But specifically, when you start looking at couples' fights and the way in which they fight and how they escalate, one of the most important psychoanalytic contributions is to recognize that fights about seemingly trivial matters, like how to load the dishwasher or someone was 3 minutes late for a dinner party, that these fights almost always involve some deeper hidden issue. So the idea, and these are often unconscious to the person, so the person themselves may not know why they're so upset about what they're upset about. And of course, the person they're complaining to will often think it's trivial. And actually, the most famous researcher, John Gottman, has studied couple therapy or couples and success or failures in their marriages, is on record saying that 80% of couples' fights are, quotes, about nothing. Now, of course, he's wrong. They're always about something, but they seem to be often about nothing. So the most important thing, perhaps one of the most important analytic contributions to couple therapy is the idea that fights happen when hidden issues come online. In other words, unconscious issues. With this in mind, so the issues that come on online often have to do with love and respect, for instance, with shame and guilt, with control, with attachment, all the issues that psychoanalysts are interested in, any one of them can be activated. So just as an example, a couple I saw recently, they got in a big fight about whether to repair a hole in a leaky roof. And, you know, it seemed silly, I think, to me and also to them, that they were having a debate about it, because obviously they need to fix the hole in the roof. But it became much more intelligible when you understood the context and what the underlying issues were, which was that they had recently moved to Chicago from another city, and they had moved because of the wife's job. The husband didn't much want to come, and also because his job actually took a hit. And they moved into a house that she picked. So the house and the move and the spending more money on it all seemed to be her issue, something that he wasn't on board with. And this, his unconscious objection to the whole thing was really what was behind the fight. And once that came out, then they did the sensible thing and spent some dough fixing the roof. So that's one important issue. Another one is simply what I call divergent meanings of events. So that psychoanalysts, just like with when Freud talked about interpreting dreams, he said that only the dreamer can interpret the dream. You can take guesses about what something might mean in a dream, but really it's somewhat subjective. The symbols in the dream are dependent on the meanings attributed to them by the dreamer. And when I teach undergraduates about this, I get to show them a video of a couple who have a big fight. And here's how the fight goes. They're a couple in the movie The Story of Us, and they're driving their kids to camp. And right after that, they're planning to separate. So they're obviously in not a good shape in their minds. But they're on the way to this to drop off the kids, and they encounter a very unusual event, which is a house being moved. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but it's like a truck pulling the house, right, is what they see. And they the wife, who is more obsessive compulsive kind of person and worried that they're not going to get there, and her husband is driving. So she starts criticizing him. Can't you go fast? Can't you go around this guy? Why can't you get by him? Meanwhile, the husband is sort of ignoring her, and he's making jokes about it. He's saying to the kids who are sitting, the two kids in the back seat, he's saying, this house, look at that. The zip code keeps changing. It's 60302, 60304, 60305. And the kids are yucking it up. And then he goes, you know, and what if somebody's taking a poop in the bathroom? Right now they're flushing. And the kids are, again, they're laughing. And the wife, if you see the wife's face, she's disgusted. And she's angry at the husband, and then she looks at him, and of course she's not laughing, and then he feels deflated. So the reason I use this example is, in a sense, they're both right, but they're both seeing a different thing. They both see the house in front of them, but she sees it as an impediment, something that they need to get around, because otherwise they'll be late. And whereas he sees an opportunity for humor, which obviously this family needs. They need good feelings. But they can't somehow resolve this event, the divergent subjective experiences that they have about the same event. And so lots of couples get into fights about what is it really. And when I talk to couples, everybody knows that if you watch a movie, two people can have very divergent experiences of the movie. One can like it, or one critic can pan it. But it's usually because they're experiencing different parts of it, or they're reacting to different parts of it. And so I think this is the origin of what I call the "you're both right" intervention, where something that a individual therapist wouldn't have to do, but a couple therapists, this is something I do every day. And as a fun sort of historical thing, I got into this business partly because my parents, when I was a kid, I was the oldest kid, and my parents would come to me complaining. Each one would complain about the other. My mom would complain about my dad, and she would complain, and she would notice things that I also didn't like about him. And I'd go, "Yeah, you're right." And then my dad would come to me and complain about things about my mom that I didn't like either. And I'd say, "You know, you're right too." And I, as a kid, I couldn't really do anything about it. I grew up to be a couple therapist, but I, even as a kid, I could see that both of them had a point. They were just like so many of the couples I see, they weren't able to be heard, and they tended to talk past each other. So that's a second critical idea that comes from psychoanalysis. And the third one that I would mention that is tremendously important is the idea of transference. In other words, and they're both negative and positive transferences. So people have had experiences in childhood which provide them a map of the world. And the negative ones are usually their fears, you know, what they're afraid of, what they think is going to happen. Will people be responsive? These are attachment schemata are an example of this. Can people be relied upon? And depending on your map, though, you will then behave in a way that fits the map. And often it'll be self-fulfilling, as we'll see in some examples later. But so, for instance, if you had a map of the world and you thought that you would, if you sailed west, you would fall, the world had an edge on it, and you would fall into the off the edge, you would never discover the new world. You wouldn't have been Columbus. And in the same way, people that have maps that say you can't trust people will not engage in trusting relationships with them. And actually, people will often feel there's something odd about, say, a paranoid person, and will, in fact, confirm their fears, their negative transference expectations, by keeping away from them. So those are the negative fears, or sometimes I call them transference allergies. People like being allergic to bee stings. If you're stung by a bee when you're a kid, then later one more bee sting and you could have an anaphylactic reaction and even die. And so this is an experience near thing that I can work with couples to point out their allergies or their expectations, their negative expectations, and how they react very strongly to a little bit of smoke. They think there's a forest fire. So that's the negative ones. The positive ones are wishes for things we often didn't have as kids, the things that we so much want that we didn't get. And often these are for someone who, say, for instance, some of these can be unrealistic, like the idea that you could, your spouse should read your mind and give you stuff without your having to ask, which of course finesses that problem I mentioned earlier about having to ask for things. But often these two things come together, the desire for something, but the fear that you won't get it often comes together. And if I could, I'm going to read, I think, Barbara, a couple of quotes from a couple of therapists in Boston, Terrence Riel. And he has two wonderful quotes in his book, The New Rules for Marriage, on both the negative and the positive one. So what he calls the negative transferences are core negative images. So he, which is a good term you can use for with couples also, like transference allergies. It's like it's their biggest fear. So what he is how he describes it. That vision of him or her that you feel most hopeless and frightened about. You say to yourself, in those furious or resigned or terrified moments, "Oh my God, what if he or she really is a vicious person, a cold-hearted witch, a betrayer, an incompetent, constricted, selfish?" Your core negative image is your worst nightmare. It's who your partner becomes in those most difficult, irrational, least loving moments. So this is, again, an extremely valuable idea when working with couples, because they're reacting to their image of the other person, often based on experiences in the past. And now when he talks about positive expectations that can get people into trouble, he says, perhaps you married your mate to steady you or to be successful for you or to give you value, abundance, culture, standing, or friends, or to stop you from drinking or start you having fun, or simply to give you the gift of not draining you dry. All these things are wonderful. They're great as gifts, but they're poison as obligations. So the whole idea of emotional maturity, of course, which individual therapists are trying to help our patients become more mature, that in couples, what you see is some combinations of negative transference of fears and excessive positive expectations that get people into trouble. As an example, and this is a personal example, so I'm revealing, again, an aspect of myself, that this is an example of what I call interlocking negative transferences. And I noticed, Barbara, you gave me some questions earlier, and that was one of them. What's an interlocking transference? So my wife and I used to get into all these fights when we'd be driving. It's not uncommon. That's another paper I'm thinking of writing, is about backseat driving problems. But in any event, the problem we would get into would be that this was before GPS. Fortunately, GPS has pretty much solved this problem that we have. But in any event, we would be driving, say, on the Indiana toll road late at night and it's raining, and Sheila would be had the map, and I would be driving, and I'd be asking her to tell me, you know, what's our, where do we turn, where do we go, what do we do next? And we would really get into it because she would start to freeze up, because partly she's not that good at maps, but she would have, don't tell her I said that, but, you know, it's a fact. But anyway.
My lips are sealed. No, this is a totally confidential interview, yeah. Right? No one will ever hear it.
Yes, I hope this is. Yeah, that's good. It's got to be totally confidential. But what she would do, she would freeze up because she would have this negative transference experience of me as like her father, who was this physics professor who would try to help her with her math. And just between you and me, she's not that great at math either, which is related to math.
Never tell that either.
She's wonderful. She's wonderful in so many other ways that are way beyond me, but this is one of her weak spots. But so when I would start hassling her and getting anxious and putting demands on her to read the map, she would not only start to get annoyed, but she would literally become unable to operate. She would, in self-psychological terms, she would fall apart or lose her cohesion. And so but then what would happen to me? Would I become a calming self-object for her? No. I would become panicked because literally when I was a kid, my mom was often depressed. And when she was depressed, she would go out of commission. And that was naturally a fearful thing for me. And so I would start to get more panicked and critical. And the more critical I got, the more Sheila would go out of commission, the more I would experience her as out of commission, the more panicked I would get. And around we'd go. And meanwhile, the kids in the back seat would start yelling at us because we were doing it again. We were doing our interlocking negative transference dance. Now, I gave this talk. I must have given this example, like, I don't know, 10 or 12 times in the lecture that I gave to this class I teach. I taught for many years Marriage 101 at Northwestern for undergraduates. But after a while, I realized that it was worse than that because it turns out my earliest memories are being lost. I actually, because my mom was depressed, there were a couple of times at once, pre-verbally, when I literally crawled out of our apartment, and another time when I was about 3 years old, and I somehow got out of the apartment and had to be brought back by a maintenance man. And so I think I have an unconscious fear of being lost, which has happened other times, with unrelated to Sheila. And I have a sensitivity not just to the parent who is not capable, but literally to the situation of being lost. And that's what happens when we're driving, is I get I mean, who cares if we go off at the exactly the right road? I mean, we'll get there. But that's not how I feel. I feel like I'm the little kid that's in a life-threatening situation if I get lost and no one's there helping. So I think then the question is, how much can we expect from insight? Because that's a basic psychoanalytic idea. Like, I know this now about myself. I know that I am super sensitive to being lost, and to someone when I'm asking for help, they don't seem to be able to come up with it. I think that may always be true for me. I mean, I don't know that I'm going to ever stop being like that. But having the insight, I'm less likely to blame the other guy. I'm much less likely, and I have backed off with Sheila. I'm not as critical. And as I said, though, we somewhat got solved. It was Deus Ex Machina, literally the machine of the GPS. But I think so there's limits on corrective experiences and insight, but nonetheless, it really tremendously helps. And so I suppose I added another important element of psychoanalysis or psychoanalytic thought to couples therapy, is helping them gain insight into their negative expectations about others, and showing them how, in the worst case scenario, both people are having theirs at the same time. The famous psychoanalyst Heinz Kohut from Chicago, one of the things he, as a quip, I don't think he actually said this in print, or if he did, it was in a footnote somewhere. He said, basically, marriage will be okay as long as there's only one crazy person at a time. And the idea was that the other person can rescue that person. So the one person is essentially drowning psychologically, the other person can rescue them. But you're out of luck if both people are drowning. And often both people are drowning in these situations of interlocking transferences. So then moving along, so there's five I'm going to try to get in here, five major contributions, but in sort of topical areas of contributions of psychoanalytic thought to couples therapy. The fourth one has to do with acceptance and forgiveness, which is a whole huge issue, and it's a chapter in my book on couple therapy on this topic. But it's interesting because the people that really put it on the map were two behaviorists, Jacobson and Christensen. And what they did was they studied their cases when they were trying to teach people safer ways to talk and how to negotiate and ask for what they wanted and in more constructive ways. And what they found was that compared to control groups, about 50% of their couples did really great, but that the other 50% didn't. And so they tried to study, scientifically oriented there, they tried to figure out, well, what was it that wasn't happening? And so then they developed a new add-on to their therapy, which they called acceptance, trying to help people accept the problems in your marriage. And this is important because there's one of these truisms is whoever you marry a set of problems. If you marry someone else, you marry a different set of problems. It's not true that, although people have an idealized fantasy that you can marry someone who has no problems, like the perfect car that you might get right off the lot would have no problems. In fact, there will be some areas of incompatibility or difficulty. And certainly you're going to face problems down the road as you have children or deal with leaky roofs. So you will marry a set of problems. And the question is, if you stop trying to change the other guy, what Jacobson and Christensen found was that people, if they could accept their partner, warts and all, then often it was really interesting. These couples did better. And if anything, there was way less fights. And so an actual area of interest that I have is when you work with couples to try to help them come to accept what Gottman and other people have called perpetual problems, those problems that keep coming up. You try to help them contain them so that they don't spoil everything. Because if you're always fighting over the fact that one person has a different idea about what counts as lateness or neatness, it's going to spoil all the good times because people can spend all their time focusing on that. But then the question is, how do you help people accept things? And that turns out analysts have a whole lot of ideas about that. One way is through things that I've already been talking about, is through increased self-awareness and awareness of unrealistic wishes. Another is to help people with the thing that we're going to talk about in a minute, projective identification, because very often what people do is they have some problem in themselves, and instead of seeing it in themselves, they see it in the other guy. And so you think that the problem is not me, it's the other person. In fact, I would say that that's almost universal in couples I see, that they think the marriage is lousy and that the other person is the louse, and that they're almost universally blaming the other person. So if you can help people in many ways to stop doing that, to reduce the blame, to take responsibility for your own contributions to the thing, that will allow you to be more accepting of inevitable problems. There's other ways to work with acceptance and forgiveness. Forgiveness, of course, is a big topic all in itself with, say, with situations of extramarital affairs, which are pretty common. But so before we go on to the projective identification topic, which I know, Barbara, you really wanted to focus on particularly, because I agree with you. I think it's a topic that's poorly understood and that I've found very valuable. Do you have any questions about what I've said already? I mean, you've been letting me go on, but I'm curious if there's anything that I wasn't clear or you wanted greater clarification or...
No, it's very clear. It's great. Let's keep going and talk about the big idea of projective identification.
Okay, so projective identification is a very challenging concept because it's actually a bunch of different things for different people, and it comes with Melanie Klein's baggage and Kleinian many other ideas that I find and other people might find problematic. But what is it really? And when I try to describe it to people, the most important thing first is to say that it is an interpersonal defense. It's an interpersonal defense, which what's that? So a intrapsychic defense might be like forgetting. Like if you don't want to go to the dentist, for instance, you might simply forget it. It's why your dentist calls you up and leaves messages, right? Because they know that people often don't like going to the dentist. And so they don't want you to do your intrapsychic defense of essentially repression. Oh, I forgot about that. So that's an intrapsychic defense. That's just between you and you. But an interpersonal defense involves other people. It's kind of a sneaky way of hiding from yourself using other people. And sort of a fun way to think about it is years ago, I went through a period I was kind of addicted to video games. And actually, it taught me a lot about addictions. Like the way you know you're addicted is if you're staying up past your bedtime and rationalizing it as, well, I'll just play one more game, that kind of thing. But in any event, before I kicked my addiction, I was really into the Legend of Zelda, which is a really good game that I understand is still in business years later. And I have younger generation people are still playing it and enjoying it. But in The Legend of Zelda, the main character is Link. And at the end of each stage, Link has to kill what we call the boss character, some particularly evil, difficult to kill person in order to advance to the next level. And in this one very sneaky level, what Link had to do is he had to fight himself. He had to fight himself, and it was really a surprise because usually it looks like some humongous, a gorilla-like thing that you have to fight. But this was like looked just like you, and you had to fight him. And the thing was, the computer programmers that designed this game had done a great job, because what they did was Blink knew what the bad guy knew what you were thinking. So if you tried to go hit him on the right, he would move left. And if you went to the left, he would move right. And so it began to feel like it was impossible to kill this guy because he could read your mind. And so this is part of the problem with just fighting it out with yourself. And it shows you the advantage of, well, potentially locating it in someone else. I mean, it's in this case, it's still in you, because you could. It turned out you could kill this bad guy, but the way he did it was you had to throw a bomb at him, which was that even though he knew where you were going to throw it, he couldn't get far enough away to net the bomb. So there was a way to do it, but what the example does, it shows you that there are some situations where it's very hard to argue with yourself. So a somewhat superficial one would be, like, you're not sure whether you can afford to buy a new car. So you're going, well, I think I really, really want a new car, but I don't think I want, but I can't afford it. But I really want it, but I can't afford it. But I really want it, I can't afford it. Okay, so you're going back and forth on that. What you could do is you could project, say, onto your partner, my wife thinks I shouldn't buy the car. She thinks I shouldn't buy the car. She's the one that's keeping me back. God damn it, why does she do that? She does that all the time. It's my money. I can spend it anywhere I want. She's such a tightwad. Okay, when you do that, now you maybe buy the car. So it's kind of a sneaky way sometimes that people, this particular thing, where you project one half of you. Now, people do it the other way, though. They can project the other part and then end up saving. So it somewhat depends on the situation, which part you project. But you can see how involved. So that's one aspect of projective identification, is to externalize an internal debate. Now, there's other things. Maybe the most common one I see with couples is to externalize a self-evaluation. And we'll have an example in a minute, an egregious example of that. But couples often want to externalize the blame for something. I went through a couple where they were in the middle of a blizzard up in Michigan somewhere, and the wife dropped the keys into a snowbank, or the keys of their car. And instead of, like, looking for, you know, try to find the keys, which you would think would be the first thing so they don't freeze to death, they spent about 10 minutes yelling back and forth as to whose fault it was. Was it her fault because she had dropped it, or was it his fault because he banged into her, which is why she dropped it? And this went on and on. And partly, for those of you that have studied group behavior, actually this is something that groups sometimes do to deal with an external problem, is they get into a fight with each other. And then that sort of is a distraction from what the real problem is. But in any event, so, and actually scapegoating is another example of that, of course. So when Hitler blames the Jews for Germany's problems after the First World War, this is essentially a blaming, externalizing the problem, locating it somewhere else. And then, of course, doing it, it's minimizing it to say it's a maladaptive solution, but it's a destructive solution that doesn't deal with the real problem, like the keys in the snowbank. But couples and families do this all the time. So that's actually the origin of family therapy, was around this sort of scapegoating of, say, a teenager whose grades aren't that good when dad just lost his job, is a way of refocusing on the wrong problem, because the right problem is the one that the family is too afraid to look at, to really address the right problem. But the third variety of projective identification, and I'm going to tell you how they go in a second, but these are the three sort of varieties. One is to externalize an internal debate. Another is a negative self-evaluation, usually. And the third one is to enact a scenario. Now, and we know that children, when they're upset, let's say their parents are getting divorced, will play it out with their dolls or soldiers or their toys. They'll play out parents, often the parents getting back together. You know, the parent, okay, so now mommy and daddy are happy with each other. And so that we all know that people do that, little kids do it in their play. Perhaps less well known is that adults do it in their sex lives. They'll play out roles. They enact roles, often ones that they don't get to do during the day. And so we know that that sort of play happens. And we know that actually we watch play, we watch movies, we read novels where people are in interesting situations that we kind of identify with them. And we then can work out something that is interesting to us. And like right now, maybe some people are watching horror movies to deal with this pandemic. But often the enacted scenario is an attempt to master a situation. So maybe some of you may have seen the movie The Deer Hunter. It's pretty far in the distant past, but it's a great example of enacted scenario as an attempt at mastery. This guy is in the Vietnam War, and he's tortured by having to play Russian roulette. And one of his buddies is killed, so the Viet Cong make him play Russian roulette, and either he's going to live or die. So it's a sadistic torture. And so the war is over, and he and his friend are saved and not killed. But the guy who was traumatized with this torture goes back to Vietnam, if you can believe it. And this is what is hard to believe. He goes back to Vietnam, and he does this thing for money. He again does Russian roulette, and he gets people to pay him to do it. But and his friend in the movie goes back to try to rescue him and get him out of that, reenacting it. But this is, we see this all the time, with people enacting traumatic situations and trying to make them come out with a happy ending. And this is, Freud thought that this was a counterexample. This was counter to his idea of, or inconsistent with his idea of the pleasure principle, that people seek out pleasurable experiences and avoid pain, which is a sort of behaviorist idea of life, which makes a lot of sense. It's just that what he saw, and that example from The Deer Hunter and other examples we'll see, people often instead of, for instance, the daughter of a critical alcoholic, you'd think the last thing she would do would be to marry another alcoholic who's critical of her. But we see this all the time. And very often we'll see the person is aware that they will marry a supportive person. But we see these repetitions. And the way to understand them is that the person is drawn to a situation where the other person can the story can come out with a different ending. But in order for it to come out with a different ending, you have to start out with players that look kind of like the initial players from the family, often from the family of origin. So it's an answer to this paradox that we see people enacting scenarios from the past. Now, sometimes the scenarios people enact are capable of coming out with a happy ending. So, for instance, it's very typical if like a patient of mine, I'll just give an example. A patient of mine had the misfortune of his grandfather died in his bedroom when he was 5 years old. And so he grew up to be an anesthesiologist. Why is that? Well, as an anesthesiologist, he could make people literally come back from the dead. He would put them to sleep and then they would come back from the dead. So it was an ability to, in a sense, master the death experience. Other people, if their dad died of a heart attack, they become cardiologists and they can help people. They can't help everybody, but they may be more willing to stay up at 3 a.m. and work with people who have a heart attack. Many people like us, like me in the mental health field, we are trying to master, like I'm trying to deal with that situation with my parents coming to me with problems, or my mom with her depressions. And to the extent that we can actually help people, that I can help my couples or my individual patients or my depressed patients, I can have a semi-mastery experience. It's why my dad always used to ask me, why would you want to be a psychiatrist? Don't you have enough problems of your own? Actually, a lot of patients friends friends will say that to you. Don't you have enough? Why would you want to do that? Why would you want to hang out with people? Well, because it allows, I think, more than average, it allows me to master a childhood situation where I couldn't control it. Now, what's the difference? Why not then? What is the problem with marrying people with a problem? The difference is that unlike heart attacks or maybe certain kinds of mental illness, it's very hard if you're married to somebody to get them to change. In fact, most people don't like it if you try to get them to change. So it's a very low probability that you will solve your problem, your earlier problem, by enacting it later in life. Okay, so that's a tremendously important point. And then actually allows me to make one other point I wanted to include in this talk, which is if you do couples therapy, one question that may be the most, if you can only ask one question of a couple, the question is, what would it be? And one answer is, it would be, what attracted you to each other? And ask each person. Because what that almost always is, at first, it's something the person needed that they didn't have. Sometimes it's like the person is shy, so they marry someone who's very outgoing. Okay. Now, that's a little different but than the projective identification thing. But let's say he was so into me. He really loved me. Okay, that might be the father that didn't love that person was now really loved. They found the thing they didn't have. But as the marriage progresses, what often happens is that attempted solution begins to backfire. The other person isn't as loving, isn't universally loving, isn't always there. And then we start getting the negative transference expectations come up. So that the attempt to master problems by marrying either the solution or the problem and hoping it'll come out different, like marrying the solution, I don't think I was that clear about that. But marrying the solution would be like if you're shy, you marry a really social person. The problem with that is, it's almost inherently flawed because after a while, you're going to be stuck with someone that wants to go out on Tuesday and Wednesday night and stay out late, and you don't because there was a reason why you weren't that social. You'll have to change you if you're going to be married to that person. And that person is going to have a problem with you because you're not going to want to do what they want to do. So attempting to marry somebody that's better at something than you sometimes can help. If like you have a division of labor, like one person plays third base and the other person's a better pitcher or something. But the marriages, often the complementary marriages don't solve your problem any more than if you were a groupie in a band, you love the band, you hang out with the band. That doesn't make you a great at playing the guitar. So it doesn't solve, just hanging out with someone isn't necessarily going to change who you are. But anyway, back to projective identification. So what are the steps and what is meant by projection and identification? So this is the confusion that everybody has. Most people understand projection because projection is just locating something that was in you in the other person. So it's not necessarily that the other person really was that way, but you start seeing them that way. Now, in and of itself, projection is really just a transference. It's a misreading of the other person. It's seeing them, say, as the defective person rather than yourself. So that step, that projection, really isn't, is if we just leave it there, it's actually still an intrapsychic thing because the other person doesn't even have to be around. They could be in another room or another country. But so what makes it projective identification? Well, the next step is, I call it induction. It's where you actually do things or don't do things to get the other person to behave, to play a role in your drama. And we'll give an example in a minute, but to get them to do it. Now, some people, you don't have to do that much. You can essentially get someone who's already typecast, who already kind of behaves that way. It doesn't need much nudging to behave that way. But other times, you're going to want to behave in a way, the more you put the other person down, for instance, the less adequate they may be. So that's an induction step, and that's the second step. They often happen at the same time. The third step is identification. Now, what's that? Who identifies? Well, as we'll see, both people actually identify. This is the confusion. Very often, the recipient of the projection will identify. So if somebody is projecting their own inadequacy into someone, and then that person begins to start to feel stupid, okay, now they are identifying with that role. In individual therapy, that's like a complementary countertransference. You are feeling what the patient wants you to feel. And sometimes it's really obvious to see how that happens. The patient will put you down and you'll feel inadequate. They'll build you up, you'll feel idealized. But if they don't pay your bills, you might feel angry at not being treated well. So these are induction steps that allow them create a certain feeling state in the recipient who may or may not act on it. But also the inducer is in touch with the roles. So it's a kind of split identification. To give you an example, a good example is the bully. You see the kid whose father beats him up at home comes to school and now is going to humiliate some other kid who's, say, smaller than them. And that, in the way they do it, of course, is in the way they induct, make that person feel small and weak is to embarrass them, for instance, or to force them to do something that hurts them, and often in public. So the group becomes part of the whole event. But while they're humiliating that person, the person is now the recipient is in the role of the bullied person. And that's it puts the bully in the active role. So they've turned their passive experience of being bullied at home into a active one where they're the bully. But they are simultaneously identifying with both roles. They're now the strong father bullying person, mean and nasty, who's in control and taking out their anger on somebody else who's weaker and seen as less deserving, good, bad, you know, and that other person is feeling the bad feelings. So this is an example of projective identification that I guess pretty much everybody has seen that kind of thing. Now, what's the cure for that? The cure in individual therapy is when the person is, you're starting to feel something that the other person can't contain. In other words, they can't contain their inadequacy. The secret is, everybody that studied this, if you start to feel what they can't handle, first you have to handle it yourself. So you have to, in the lingo of the Kleinians, is you have to contain it, which is actually not such a bad metaphor for a projection, because the idea is something has been put into you, and so rather than acting it out, you contain it, you then metabolize it, you feed it back to the person in a manageable way. But what you're really trying to do is, as after you contain it and understand it, like say if you were being bullied by, let's say you're being bullied by a patient or by your husband or by your wife, you're being criticized unfairly. So this is the challenge of being unfairly criticized. What you have to do is, you have to not take it personally. You have to calm yourself. You have to think to yourself, I wonder why this person needs to locate their own trouble in me. And then you start talking with them to help that person live with it rather than project it, rather than do the projective identification dance with you. So that's a tremendously valuable idea about a lot of therapy, individual therapy, in the sense of how the therapist may help people deal with stuff that they cannot yet deal with. And then also couples therapy, because situations in couples, and I'll give you an example in a sec, but where people project into one person, ideally the spouse would be able to contain it and help that person, the projector, to contain it and stop enacting it. That would be the ideal. But actually, in real life, in couples therapy, usually that job comes to the therapist. The therapist will have to do that.
In the time we have left, what would the therapist do? They would see...
Well, let me give you an example.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, what would they do? No, see, so you're still seeing the couple conjointly, okay?
Yes.
So let me give you the example. The example of Rachel and Matt. So this is a couple, they came in shortly after the wife's business had failed. And her complaint was that her husband gave her a, quote, sick feeling and disgust, and that he was disgusting. Why was he disgusting? It was because he wasn't making enough money. He wasn't making enough money. He was actually making more than $100,000 a year, but he wasn't making as much as she thought he should because some of their friends' husbands were making more. So I'm listening to this, and I'm thinking, holy shit, you know, I'm thinking like, I'm feeling sorry for this guy. I feel like this is outrageous. It's so obvious that this woman is locating her own sense of defectiveness in him and ragging on him and threatening to divorce him and insulting him in front of me and getting her friends to agree with her that he's a poor excuse for a guy. So that was how they presented. What I had to do was, first of all, contain my own negative reaction to her, which is a common thing in couple therapy. If you find yourself siding with one person more than the other, that can be fatal over time. So you have to work hard to try to understand it from her point of view. So that's what I tried to do. I want to say just a couple more other things, why this was a great example of projective identification. Because the more she did that with him, the worse he did at work. He started to lose clients. Actually, when I looked at him, I thought I wouldn't go to this guy. He was a lawyer. I wouldn't go to this guy for legal advice. He looks like, you know, he couldn't handle anything. And because he was so beaten down by her. And then she also said, you know, and also he's terrible in bed. You know, he can't get it up. And well, of course he couldn't get it up because she kept telling him he couldn't get it up. And he was a poor excuse for a man. And he was giving her a sick feeling and all that stuff. And so naturally, at least given his psychology, he became a crappier lover. So he was a lousy lover. He was actually, she had managed to get him to be even worse at work, which actually I thought he was pretty good at work. So how did I deal with it? The main thing was to try to help her live with less than perfect. In other words, accept herself so she didn't have to enact it with him. And the way that went was, the usual things that probably most of the therapists listening to this would know how to do was to help her talk about the business failure. Why was this so bad? How did this intersect with her childhood, which it did, because her dad had always been very critical of her. Her dad was a very successful businessman. So she had this idea that she herself also, and her business had failed. And so it would be like helping someone mourn, be the sort of almost technical, too technical term, mourn the loss of their business or the thing that she thought was so important. And over time, I helped her to regain her own sense of confidence, to go back to a different line of work, which actually brought some money in, not as much as, it wasn't as sexy a business or job, but it gave her some companionship and some money and some self-esteem and organized her day. The other thing that came out in the therapy was that as she felt understood by me, her husband actually was an extremely supportive guy. And he had been really supportive of her earlier in life, which is probably why she married him. When she was in college, she'd been addicted to drugs and he'd been very helpful in getting her off it. And that happened again. So she then confessed that she had gone back to using drugs as a way of coping with this loss, and she was embarrassed about that. But as in lots of good therapy, when the person starts to feel it's safe and they confess their seeming, you know, terrible failings in life, she began to be able to contain it herself, and he was supportive of her. And their marriage, interestingly, I had this follow-up 15 years later. She came back to talk to me about dealing with her parents who were aging, and her dad had died. And the thing that really you could see was how their marriage had held up and really gone from being about to go off the cliff of divorce with her hating him and him terribly depressed to them very supportive of each other and really happy with their kids and their life together because of this reversal of the projective identification defense that she had been using. So I hope that gives you a taste of it. And of course, if you're interested in, you know, more on this, please feel free to read my book or my papers on the topic. And I think Barbara probably can, you know, include that in somewhere in the stuff that goes with this talk.
I will absolutely do that, Dr. Nielsen. This is a terrific interview. We could go on for another hour at least. I really enjoy talking with you. And I think we're going to return to you, as I interviewed you in the past, some years back, on the subject of the first interview in psychotherapy. So now we're talking about couples. So thank you, Dr. Nielsen, so very much. What fun this has been.
Thank you, Barbara. Thanks for giving me the opportunity. I really enjoyed doing this.
This concludes our interview with Dr. Arthur Nielsen. We hope you have learned from this interview and that you enjoyed it. You may contact Dr. Nielsen at arthur@arthurnielsenmd.com and at 312-649-0570. As always, the views of our speakers are theirs alone and do not necessarily reflect the views of On Good Authority. On behalf of On Good Authority, this is Barbara Alexander. Thank you for listening.